I've never heard so much malarkey in my whole life.
I've never seen anybody lie like this guy.
Personal jabs and insults in the first presidential debate. Highlights of the historic face-off and analysis from a Catholic perspective. The United States Supreme Court prepares to end its term with some major opinions, including one about abortions that is frustrating advocates on both sides of the issue. Our legal expert joins us to discuss decisions announced this week. And quiet time for reflection, adoration, and procession at Mother Angelica's Shrine in Alabama. Perpetual pilgrims headed to the National Eucharistic Congress stop to share their transformative faith experiences. EWTN News in Depth starts now.
They've dismissed the emergency appeal. What this means, practically speaking, is that women in Idaho, even despite Idaho's very restrictive abortion laws, will be able to still get emergency abortions.
The Supreme Court kicks an abortion case back to the lower courts and releases multiple decisions on other cases ranging from social media to homelessness to the power of government agencies. Welcome to EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. Several of the decisions have divided the court along ideological lines. These decisions will have profound implications on health care, free speech, religious freedom, and the power of government. The High Court released two major decisions on Friday, both split 6-3 along those ideological lines. In Grants Pass v. Johnson, the court ruled that cities can enforce bans on homeless people sleeping outside in public places. It found that such laws do not amount to cruel and unusual punishment, even in areas where shelter space is scarce. In Loper Bright Enterprises v. Raimondo, the court reversed decades of regulatory law, making it more difficult for federal agencies to issue mandates and regulations that aim at filling in the gaps of legislation passed by Congress. In Justice Roberts' opinion, he rejected the suggestion that agencies, rather than courts, are better suited to determine what ambiguities a federal law might mean. Justice Kagan sharply criticized the decision, saying that the court has given itself exclusive power over every open issue. One of the cases centered on abortion was inadvertently and briefly posted on the court's website one day prior to the official decision, which was released on Thursday. It is the second time in 2 years that a major Supreme Court abortion decision seems to have leaked before the official release. In this case, Idaho and Moyle versus the United States, neither pro-lifers nor pro-abortionists are claiming a win.
Unfortunately, even though this is good news, we know that that's now going to plod through the lower courts.
I was very disappointed that the court didn't at least keep the stay in place, because before they at least had stayed the decision.
Advocates on both sides of the abortion issue left disappointed after the Supreme Court once again leaves major questions unanswered in its decision. In a limited ruling, the Supreme Court ruled on Thursday that Idaho is required to perform emergency abortions under the Emergency Medical Treatment and Active Labor Act, also known as EMTALA. Originally passed in 1986, the federal law was created to prevent hospitals from dumping emergency room patients who could not afford treatment. In 2022, the Biden administration updated guidance on the law to include emergency abortions and sued Idaho over its pro-life law that limits that. In a 5-4 decision, the court punted the questions posed in the case back to the lower courts, and in a 6-3 vote, it removed its previous stay that prevented the EMTALA guidance from taking full effect in Idaho.
The case has been a bit of a moving target, both because the Idaho law has changed somewhat in the pendency of the litigation, and because the United States, in its arguments to the Supreme Court, made a lot of serious concessions.
This ruling does not impact similar pro-life laws in more than a dozen states and keeps Idaho's law mostly intact. Pro-abortion advocates saw it as a temporary victory, and pro-life advocates saw it as a setback. While HHS Secretary Javier Becerra praised the ruling, he emphasized that it does not change the fact that reproductive freedom is under attack. The Biden-Harris administration is committed to protecting access to emergency medical care for everyone in America and ensuring that women get the care they need. Idaho's Attorney General Raul Labrador promised to keep fighting the Biden administration's lawsuit.
I remain committed to protect unborn life and ensure women in Idaho receive necessary medical care. We feel good about where we sit today, and we look forward to the Ninth Circuit actually reading the tea leaves from the Supreme Court and understanding that the Biden administration's overreach needs to end.
And joining us now is Christina Martinez Squires, attorney at Cher Jaffe, to help us understand the implications of these Supreme Court cases. Christina, thank you so much for joining us. There's been a flurry of important Supreme Court decisions. I want to address the EMTALA one first, concerning abortions in Idaho. What exactly did the Supreme Court decide here?
So it's very hard. It's a very hard opinion to digest because there is a lot of writing going on from amongst the different justices. But the headline is that the Idaho law is now stayed in terms of what the district court said was allowed to go into effect. So certain parts of it can't, to the extent that it conflicts with federal law and doesn't allow abortions in certain situations. And the court decided that they would wait to make a full merits decision later on. So that's the headline of what came out of that case.
What's your initial reaction to that decision?
I'm not surprised. I think the case did morph a lot from the time that the court accepted it, and the court accepted it in an emergency posture. And since the time the court decided to do that, from the time a decision would have come out, the law actually changed. It was amended by the Idaho legislature. The Idaho Supreme Court weighed in on what the law actually meant, and the government's position on what EMTALA meant also changed. So there were a lot of moving parts. So even though it seems bizarre that the court would have sent it back down after the extensive briefing, over 2 hours of oral argument, it's not surprising given how the contours of the case have changed over time.
On that point, Justices Jackson, Alito, Thomas, and Gorsuch all thought that the court should resolve the question of whether the federal law overrides Idaho's law. Here's what Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson had to say, quote, "While this court dawdles and the country waits, pregnant people experiencing emergency medical conditions remain in a precarious position. This court had a chance to bring clarity and certainty to this tragic situation, and we have squandered it." You know, Christina, pro-life advocates are disappointed that abortions will continue in Idaho, obviously. But what is next for this case, and could the Supreme Court ultimately take this up again?
They absolutely could, and they will very soon, is my prediction. So I think what people forget is it's not just this case challenging EMTALA, but a very similar case has also already been petitioned to the Supreme Court on the behalf of the state of Texas, who actually sued the federal government over their law being in conflict with the federal law. And so that case, the court asked for Texas to file a response in just the next few weeks. And unlike the Idaho case, that one was fully briefed and finalized in the lower court. So the Supreme Court won't have the same reason to reject it as it did with the Idaho case.
So just to kind of flesh that out a little bit more, this case, could it have bearing on other states as their pro-life laws also face legal challenges?
It could, to the extent that it's obvious that those laws conflict with federal law. So I think when people say this is just confined to Idaho, that's not quite true, because the question more is about when this federal interpretation of EMTALA conflicts with the state law, what does that mean and which one wins? And so that has a lot of ramifications for other states that have abortion restrictions, maybe not the same as Idaho's, right, but similar.
Really helpful clarity there. In other huge news, the Supreme Court upended the 40-year-old Chevron decision. Christina, how significant is this?
Incredibly significant, and much more so in the short and long term, I think, than even any of the abortion cases it had this term. I mean, this precedent had been around, like you said, for decades. It had really given the federal agencies tremendous power to legislate, essentially, to do Congress's job. So this is definitely, I think, the biggest case of the term, people would probably say.
You know, speaking of this case, the Little Sisters of the Poor, they actually filed a friend of the court brief last year in support of the fishermen that were involved in this Chevron case that we're discussing. Christina, can you explain what implications this case has for religious liberty and conscience rights?
It has tremendous implications for religious liberty and conscience rights, because as we've seen particularly the last two presidential terms, when a president comes into power, appoints people and to lead these agencies, they're using these agencies for very political ends. And so we've seen that with abortion. We've seen it with, you know, the contraceptive mandate even a decade ago. Now, the hot topic for that is transgender care. And so the heads of these agencies are using statutes to their political ends, interpreting them the way they want. And the court basically today really curtailed a lot of the agency's ability to do that and said, if you do this, we can overrule you because we're taking essentially a first review. We're not going to defer to how you're twisting these statutes for political ends.
As we're talking about this case, and you mentioned just how significant this week's ruling is when it comes to overturning Chevron, can you just clearly define what that Chevron ruling is and practically means for our viewers?
Absolutely. So Chevron came about 40 years ago, and it was a rule that the Supreme Court announced that said when a statute was ambiguous, a statute that was passed by Congress, the agency in charge of implementing that statute, whatever their interpretation of that ambiguity was, would get tremendous deference from the court. So only unless it was very outrageous or something so unreasonable would the court overturn or have a different interpretation of the statute. And what the court said today basically was, we're not going to give that type of deference anymore. The court's job, the judicial role, is to interpret law. And so whatever the agency says, we're still going to take the first review without owing any deference to their interpretation of the law.
Thank you for that clarity. Okay, another big important case. The Supreme Court decided on Friday cities can enforce bans on homeless people sleeping outdoors, even in West Coast areas where shelter space is lacking. Can you break down this Supreme Court decision as well?
Absolutely. So I think it's important to note the restriction that was in place in this case was actually not just targeted towards homeless people. It was just a general ban on encampment in public spaces. And so that was part of the Supreme Court's analysis. The plaintiffs challenged it, saying that this was cruel and unusual punishment under the Eighth Amendment that targeted homeless people. And although it had a disproportionate effect on homeless people, the court essentially said, this is not cruel and unusual punishment. It's not targeted towards homeless people. It's just a ban across encampment in general. And the Eighth Amendment is not really about what conduct is criminal. It is about the types of punishments that are administered and to make sure that those are not cruel and unusual. And here, the challenge was really to the law, not about the punishment.
Christina, we have just under a minute, but I want to ask you this question while we have you. The High Court dismissed another case earlier this month about the safety of mifepristone. So two high-profile cases that had limited rulings. Does this point to how the court handles the life issue after the Dobbs decision, in your opinion?
I think so. I think it's great that this Chevron case came out first before those cases will be addressed on the merits, because now we don't have the FDA's interpretations and HHS's interpretations standing in the way of the Supreme Court saying, you know, what these agencies have done is completely out of line. And so I think it's phenomenal that we have this now open door for the court to look at these things in the first instance without having to get over the hurdle of what these agencies are doing for political purposes.
Christina, thank you so much. Great to speak with you.
Thank you.
Another decision from the High Court this week, this one on free speech. The justices threw out a lawsuit that sought to limit the government's ability to regulate posts on social media. Republican-led states and other groups claimed the Biden administration was working with social media platforms to suppress conservative posts. In a 6-3 vote, the justices ruled the plaintiffs did not have legal standing to sue, sending the case back to a lower court. Joel Thayer, president of the Digital Progress Institute, says the court's decision did not surprise him.
It really doesn't move the needle one way or the other, from my view. You actually have to put forward legislation if you really do want to increase transparency and, you know, at least increase the amount of healthy discussion in the marketplace ideas, at least with respect to online discussions.
The Supreme Court will finish this term and release all remaining decisions on Monday. But the justices are already starting to fill their docket for the fall term. The Supreme Court has agreed to hear a challenge to Tennessee's ban on gender transition procedures for minors. The Biden administration and numerous advocacy groups asked the court to intervene after an appeals court upheld the law. This case could impact similar laws in at least 20 states that ban the treatments. Oral arguments will likely be heard in the fall, with a decision released by next summer. There is so much more ahead on this edition of EWTN News in Depth, including this important matchup.
It's a very sad day in America.
President Biden, you have the mic.
Every single thing he said is a lie.
Millions tune in to the first presidential debate of the year. It's president versus former president, with America's future on the line. Analysis from our expert panel at the intersection of Catholic faith and politics when we return. And later, the case of a controversial priest accused of sexually assaulting nuns is in the news after Catholic journalists raised questions about why his artwork is still on display on Vatican websites. EWTN News in Depth is coming right back.
We created 15,000 new jobs. We brought out the position where we have 800,000 new manufacturing jobs. But there's more to be done. There's more to be done. Working class people are still in trouble.
We have the greatest economy in the history of our country. He has not done a good job. He's done a poor job, and inflation's killing our country.
A focus on the economy kicked off the nearly two-hour presidential debate Thursday night. The event began in an undiplomatic fashion. Candidates did not shake hands or even acknowledge each other from the moment they walked on stage. The historic debate, the first of the campaign season, was peppered with insults hurled from each candidate throughout the night. The moderators continually tried to get both Biden and Trump to stay focused on answering their questions, but many times the discussion devolved into rants against one another. At points, it got personal. President Biden calling out Trump's felony convictions in New York, Trump blasting Biden's son, Hunter's felony conviction, and alleged that Biden could be charged and convicted of crimes after he leaves office. Some of the main topics tackled included abortion, immigration, health care, foreign relations, and war. Both President Biden and former President Trump shared sharply different visions on virtually every core issue.
As far as Russia and Ukraine, if we had a real president, the president that knew, that was respected by Putin, he would have never invaded Ukraine.
All that money we give Ukraine are from weapons we make here in the United States. We give them the weapons, not the money at this point. And our NATO allies have produced as much funding for Ukraine as we have. That's why we're strong.
President Trump claimed the war in Ukraine and the Hamas attack in Israel would never have happened if he were in charge. He also blasted Biden's withdrawal from Afghanistan. President Biden affirmed his position on both deadly wars, reiterating Israel's endorsement of the U.S. plan to resolve the Israel-Hamas conflict and his support of Ukraine and NATO. Another topic moderators asked about were the candidates' ages and their competency. 78-year-old Trump would be 82 at the end of his term. Trump says that he has aced recent cognitive tests, which he shared with the public, and that he is in good physical shape. Biden, age 81, would be 86 at the end of his term. But throughout the debate, President Biden seemed to struggle to clearly communicate, often correcting himself in the moment or losing train of thought.
Making sure that we're able to make every single solitary person eligible for what I've been able to do with the dealing with everything we have to do with. Look,
I really don't know what he said at the end of that sentence. I don't think he knows what he said either.
This public stumble has led to rumors that Biden will be replaced with another candidate for the Democratic Party. To provide reaction and analysis on the debate, we are joined once again by two Catholic scholars who write extensively on the intersection of the Catholic faith and politics. Francis Meyer is a senior fellow in the Catholic Studies program at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. And Dr. Kenneth Craycraft is professor of moral theology at Mount St. Mary's Seminary and School of Theology in Cincinnati, Ohio. Gentlemen, welcome back to our program. During the debate this week, there was an extended exchange on the abortion issue. Let's take a listen to that.
The Supreme Court just approved the abortion pill, and I agree with their decision to have done that, and I will not block it. He's willing to, as we say, rip the baby out of the womb in the ninth month and kill the baby. Nobody wants that to happen, Democrat or Republican. Nobody wants it to happen.
That is simply not true. The Roe v. Wade does not provide for that. That's not the circumstance. Only if a woman's life is in danger, she's going to die. That's the only circumstance in which that can happen. But we are not for late-term abortion, period, period, period.
I don't want to pass over the fact that we just heard former President Trump say that he does support abortion pills, which are the most common form of abortion today. Gentlemen, what stood out to you on where the candidates fell on the abortion issue? Fran, I'll start with you.
Well, neither of them was a Catholic perspective. I mean, I think that former President Trump was the better of the two positions. I think he was fairly articulate on the matter. It's not what we would want, but it's certainly better than the current administration supports. So in general, I think he did very well on that issue.
Ken, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, well, first of all, Biden seems to think that with the stroke of a presidential pen, he can restore the status quo ante Dobbs case from a couple of years ago and restore Roe v. Wade. That isn't going to happen. Moreover, of course, he misrepresented what Roe stood for. Roe, together with its companion case, Doe versus Bolton, certainly did permit abortion up to the time of birth, full-term abortions. So he misrepresented that. And of course, that's the position that he would like to restore somehow. Of course, it's not a federal question anymore. So in some sense, the argument is moot, but it does show where the candidates stand. In terms of Trump, I agree with Fran that certainly Trump's position is better than Biden's. But it would be a mistake to call Trump a pro-life candidate. He took some public policy positions in his first term that he knew would appeal to a certain voters' bloc, and he fulfilled those. But President Trump in his second term is not going to fight for the rights of the unborn. He essentially has already said that he's more or less washed his hands of that issue, and that now it's up to the states. And since it's not a federal issue, in his mind, then there's no point in talking about it very much anymore.
I should also point out President Biden said that he is against late-term abortion, but that seems to go against a lot of the messaging from the Democratic Party as well. On this same topic, pro-life leader Lila Rose posted on X during the debate, quote, Trump's policy, okay with killing most babies. Biden's policy, okay with killing all. Not a very great contrast. So again, just to follow up on this, do pro-life voters have a candidate this election? Ken?
Well, that's a very difficult question, and I think it's really going to be up to the conscience of the individual voter. I don't mean to punt on this case at all, but on the other hand, it isn't clear that there is a pro-life candidate, and it's also not clear that there is a candidate that clearly stands out as one that a Catholic can vote for in good conscience, even if the pro-life issue is the one issue. So I'm not sure that there's a candidate in the two major parties that a Catholic can look to as the candidate to vote for on this particular issue. And of course, there are other issues that are important as well, and we shouldn't dismiss those. Right. But in terms of abortion, I wouldn't call former President Trump a pro-life candidate. Certainly, he's not an advocate for abortion the way that Biden is, but that's a far cry mm-hmm. from calling him a pro-life candidate and calling him a candidate that, at least from the abortion point of view or the abortion debate, that Trump would be the mm-hmm. person to vote
for. Fran, did you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I look at it. Ken and I, there's really no distance in our views. I mean, I felt that he was very sincere, Trump, when he was talking about the obscenity of late term abortion. And Ken is correct. The president, President Biden, was just, clueless in terms of what Roe v. Wade actually legitimized. And that was very disturbing. Neither of these guys was impressive last night. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were, the whole thing was rather embarrassing. And actually, I had to get up and walk away a few times to prevent myself from blowing a gasket. But I was struck by Trump's, at least his sincerity on the late-term abortion issue. He's mm-hmm. not perfect by any means. He's simply not a pro-life candidate. But between the two, I mean, it's mm-hmm. if you have to choose, I mean, he does have, on that issue, he has the better position.
Well, speaking of other important topics, the topic of immigration was also debated. Let's take a listen to what the candidates had to say.
When he was president, he was separating babies from their mothers, putting them in cages, making sure the families were separated. That's not the right way to go.
We had the safest border in history. Now we have the worst border in history. There's never been anything like it. And people are dying all over the place.
What should Catholic voters take away from the immigration topic at this week's debate? And were there other moments that stood out to you as significant? Fran, I'll go to you first.
Well, I think the border is a genuine mess, and I don't think the current administration has done anywhere nearly enough to solve that problem. It's just a terrible embarrassment. I think in general, though, on the Trump side, his narcissism was really offensive. I think he refused to engage certain issues that were very important ones, like Social Security, child care, things like that, that he just simply ignored. On the other hand, I mean, Biden was just not even there half the time. So it's terrible to have this conversation because it's like late Roman Republic behavior. Mm-hmm. It really is deeply disturbing. In terms of how to think about the election, the best advice I can give is to simply download a copy of the 1998 Living the Gospel of Life statement that the bishops made. It's on their website, Living the Gospel of Life 1998. And it really is a very simple, short, and very direct and clear directive about how to think about Catholic citizenship and, and the importance of voting. I don't know what to, beyond that, I don't know really how to advise on this.
Ken, any thoughts in regards to the immigration exchange or other moments at the debate?
Yeah, on immigration, I want to highlight this because this is a very important topic that Catholics need to pay more attention to. And the way that I would characterize both candidates is that they want to fix with a scalp with a sledgehammer what requires the care of a scalpel. And on both sides, you don't have anybody showing any kind of nuance. And what really dismays me about the immigration policy is that both sides reduce migrants to political pawns. On the one hand, you have President Trump using anecdotal, tragic to be sure, and I don't want to downplay, but anecdotal examples of immigrants committing crimes. On the other hand, you have Biden basically using immigration as a political cudgel to beat his opponents over the head. What's missing in both of those are authentic problems related to immigration, especially immigration related to persecution, political and religious persecution, which need to be separated from economic migration. You don't see that. You don't see those kinds of debates. And I think that's very disappointing. I would echo Fran's concern about both candidates, Trump's narcissism and Trump's refusal to take a responsibility for his own moral shortcomings. And Biden, we have to be careful that we don't tease, make fun, laugh. But the fact is, Biden is a tragic candidate at this point. I don't believe that he's intellectually fit to hold office. And I think that was demonstrated last night. I think the Democratic Party is scrambling because of that.
On that very point, with my brief remaining amount of time with you both, I want to get to this because, to your point, the major headline following the debate was Biden's poor performance. And I say this with all due respect, but it was hard to watch him openly fumble his words on stage. So how do we as voters, as Catholic voters, balance respecting the dignity of someone who is aging and is elderly with also justly judging whether someone is competent for the highest office? Ken, I'll go to you first, and then Fran, you'll get the last word.
Well, first of all, we have to make that distinction. To say that we have to have sympathy and even empathy for someone who is struggling with what clearly looks to me like dementia is one thing, but to say that that person should be president of the United States is quite another. So certainly we should be empathetic, but that doesn't mean that he wins our vote because of that empathy. And I think both his family and his party have a moral responsibility to look hard at themselves as to why they're putting this man out there as a candidate when clearly he's not up to the job.
Fran, just a moment left. What are your thoughts?
Well, I agree with Ken on the really the embarrassment of this man's competence right now. And it does deserve our sympathy. But I just don't know how the Democratic Party replaces him, because he was advanced as a candidate of the center and turned out to be something else. And everybody behind him is more extreme than he is. So I don't know where we are. I mean, I've never been, and I'm 75. I have never been in this circumstance before where we're just in this situation where both candidates are equally unpleasant. There was a time I can remember when I might not vote for a Democratic candidate, but I respected them, and I respected the Republican candidate as well. It's just a very weird time.
It is. And we're going to have to leave it at that. But as always, we are grateful for you both. Thank you.
Thank you
very much. Thank you.
When we return, we are back on the trail of the National Eucharistic Pilgrimage. Monse Alvarado joins us from Mother Angelica's home.
This is the shrine of the Most Blessed Sacrament, a place of rest and adoration that Mother Angelica envisioned after an encounter with El Divino Niño in Colombia. And the pilgrims decided to stop here for a couple of days and are joined by pilgrims from around the area for adoration and procession. We'll have that story for you coming up next.
We got to hang out with the sisters today. They were super joyful and cool. I didn't expect them to be so cool. They were really cool. I actually like them. I wanted to talk to them more.
a joyous and restful respite for pilgrims on the National Eucharistic Pilgrimage as they visit with the Poor Clares of Perpetual Adoration, the nuns of Mother Angelica's order at her Shrine of the Most Blessed Sacrament in Hanceville, Alabama. It was the halfway point for pilgrims on the southern St. Juan Diego route as they progressed through eight states on their way to the National Eucharistic Congress in Indianapolis. Today, we share their reflections as these young people experience faith in a way they have never experienced it before, both for themselves and as a witness to others. Monse Alvarado has our report.
After a month on the road, the Shrine of the Most Blessed Sacrament in Hanceville, Alabama, received the perpetual pilgrims of the Southern Juan Diego route for a four-day silent retreat and much-needed rest. Traveling through four states with four states left to go, they processed the month behind them and the National Eucharistic Congress ahead. And for the first time, delivered their personal intentions for prayer to the Poor Clares of Perpetual Adoration.
We were so tired. I didn't realize how much we needed the rest until we got here. As perpetual pilgrims, we've been collecting intentions and praying for those intentions. But for the first time, we got to give our intentions to other people to be prayed for. These were my own personal intentions that I gave to the sisters. And I have actually a special rosary from someone I received in the Diocese of Brownsville. And I've been praying with it every day. And I'm going to give it back to this person when I see her at the Congress.
Mackenzie Warrens, the team lead and a candidate for consecrated virginity in Houston, adds how the sisters are pilgrims in their own way.
Everywhere we go, the hospitality is overwhelming. But it's just really nice coming here and like hearing the sisters pray and just like being like, they're right there interceding for us. Just around the clock, they're always praying. And we gave them a stack of our intentions this morning, which was also a huge grace. Like, no one gets to do that. And so we know they're going to be carrying those intentions with them as we continue to Indianapolis.
The cohort of perpetual pilgrims includes these two seminarians who just met but became fast friends.
Here at the shrine of the Most Blessed Sacrament, you have Jesus in this magnificent monstrance of gold and surrounded by like jewels and precious gems in a sanctuary like covered, painted in gold. But that same very Jesus is traveling around in a van.
Yeah.
With eight pilgrims and a few friars and a priest. And he's also being brought like into every sort of neighborhood, every sort of walk of life.
There's this kid that came up and started talking with me and Noah. I was just kind of blown away by how much like the Holy Spirit was at work in this kid. Just like he was asking the big questions. He was like things like you wouldn't expect like a little kid to start talking about. And that was a very, very touching moment for me. It's just see like, yeah, the Holy Spirit is alive and well in the church. And there's so many good things happening, even in the smallest of us.
We also asked the pilgrims, has their love for the Eucharist changed? Talking about coming to the Eucharist with childlike faith, Shayla Elm was visibly moved by one particular little pilgrim.
This little girl got away from her family, and she comes up to the priests and the deacons and the servers, and she asks one of the deacons, "What is that?" She points to the monster and says, "What is that?" And the deacon said, "That's Jesus." And she goes up to him, to the monstrance, kisses her little hand, and touches the bottom of the monstrance, and then just scurries away. I had a front row seat to it. I watched the entire thing happen, and it was a moment deeply where I was like, that's me. That little girl was me. I just started weeping.
Joshua Velasquez, a student at the University of Notre Dame, shared a message God gave him in adoration that he now wants others to know, too.
What had happened to me in that moment, and over the course of that conference, was just God weaving threads of ideas that eventually were able to break a very fundamental lie, the lie that somehow the love of God needs to be earned. Mm. And in that moment of adoration, with that lie being dispelled in my heart, finally, the love of the Father was able to pour forth through the Son, who is the revelation of that love, in a very strong and tangible way, in the way that I can only respond with a yes.
One pilgrim, Charlie McAuliffe, likened his growth in love for the Eucharist to his preparation for marriage.
Spending time with our Lord, being with him, it has only increased my love for him. I'm in a stage of my life where I'm graduated college, and the Lord is very much preparing me for marriage. And there's this part of me that is anticipating my spouse, anticipating my bride, anticipating that part of my heart that almost completes it and I get to share life with. But I don't have that right now. And so as I walk in pilgrimage, I'm constantly reminded of this.
And in addition to increasing his love for the Eucharist, McAuliffe says beautiful joys and deep sorrows have marked his pilgrimage experience. He didn't hesitate to share when I asked him about his favorite moment from the pilgrimage so far.
My favorite moment of pilgrimage has been June 2nd. June 2nd is actually my birthday.
Oh.
And there was a lot of that whole day, I was able to see the hand of the Lord in everything that happened. It was actually the day that my grandfather passed away. Just the fact that we started the day in Galveston and my parents were there, and they got to just give me the news that he was on hospice, and how great of a gift it was to be with my parents and get to hug them and be consoled by them. We were actually in a time of adoration when he passed, and there was just this profound peace that I was able to receive with it. And my prayer for him all day was just that Mary holds his hand. I had the privilege to step away from pilgrimage for a couple days, be with my family, and go to the funeral. My papa is the kind of guy that maybe said 5 words to you, but you just saw him love. And so I'm very reminded in the Eucharist of how the Lord just waits for us with this very patient, very humble presence, and is constantly pouring out that love upon us.
After he shared his story, I asked him if he was eager to return to the challenges of the pilgrimage.
My heart was just kind of yearned to be with the team. I would text them and I would check in every day, and I would laugh with them when they sent me funny videos, funny pictures. And the night that I got to be back with them, one of our teammates, Dylan, I called him. I said, Dylan, where are we staying tonight? Like, where's the bed? He goes, I'll come find you, and hangs up the phone. And then I see him sprinting around the building, and he gives me this big hug. He says, welcome back.
This journey with Christ has seemed to only increase the pilgrims' love for our Lord in the Eucharist and each other, their time at the shrine refueling them for the journey ahead. From Hanceville, they made their way first through downtown Atlanta and then through the heart of Nashville, with now less than a month away to the National Eucharistic Congress. In Hanceville, Alabama, Montse Alvarado, EWTN News in depth.
And we will bring you more images of the Eucharistic procession at the shrine later in the program. Now, a look at some highlights from the other routes this week. The North Marion route processed along southeastern Wisconsin, and our team was there to catch pilgrims' last stops before reaching Illinois. In Kenosha, more than 400 pilgrims, young and old, walked with our Lord, making holy stops at churches along a four-mile stretch. Local parishioners shared an hour of power, of praise and worship, adoration, and inspiring talks with a small group of perpetual pilgrims traveling the entire Marion route. And from the east, pilgrims processed by steamboat across the Ohio River in a Eucharistic boatercade. Hundreds of pilgrims on the St. Elizabeth and Seton route lined up for 30 miles along the Steubenville shores of the river, waiting for the steamboat carrying the Eucharist to pass by. Pilgrims then celebrated Mass at a ballpark. Bishop Ed Malesic held bilingual adoration and Mass at Akron's Canal Park, where more than 900 people participated. Talk about a home run. And finally, from the West St. Junipero Serra route, pilgrims celebrated St. Patrick's Day a few months late in the Diocese of Des Moines. St. Patrick's Parish welcomed pilgrims with an Irish celebration, complete with an Irish band, fireworks, and overnight adoration. Earlier in the day, pilgrims walked 5 miles along the Wabash Trace Nature Trail, undaunted by the three-digit temperatures. The pilgrims from all routes will end up in Indianapolis in mid-July for the National Eucharistic Congress, now just 2.5 weeks away. To be a part of it all, register at ewtn.com/Eucharist, and you can receive a discounted pass. Monse and I will both be there. Monse on stage as a host for the Congress itself, and I will be there to provide live coverage for our EWTN network. I will be co-hosting July 17th through the 21st with Father Aquinas Gilbo, University Chaplain at the Catholic University of America, and Pete Burak, Vice President of Renewal Ministries. In-depth reporters Mark Irons and Roselle Regis will be there, too, to report on special event moments. Top headlines are next. In the Week in Review, more controversy over the use of sacred art created by a disgraced priest. Julian Assange is free, and bad news for the nation's first publicly funded Catholic charter school. We'll be right back.
WikiLeaks' work will continue, and Mr. Assange, I have no doubt, will be a continuing force for freedom of speech and transparency in government.
A lawyer for Julian Assange comments on his future, and the WikiLeaks founder is set free after a court hearing in the U.S. Commonwealth of Saipan, in which he pleaded guilty to one count under the U.S. Espionage Act of unlawfully obtaining and publishing U.S. military secrets. The end to a years-long international legal battle tops the Week in Review. The deal with the U.S. Justice Department came after Assange spent 12 years holed up in an Ecuadorian embassy in London or in a British prison. Assange arrived in his native Australia on Wednesday, hours after his guilty plea, greeting supporters with a celebratory raised fist. Assange was accused of receiving and publishing hundreds of thousands of top secret war logs and diplomatic cables, including details of alleged U.S. military wrongdoing in both Iraq and Afghanistan. He and his advocates claimed he was acting as a journalist with press freedom under the First Amendment. The U.S. government claimed he violated the Espionage Act without regard to consequences and put lives at risk. His case dragged on for years as he fought extradition to the United States to stand trial. Analysts say the resolution, after years of high stakes back and forth, allows both sides to claim a degree of vindication. Assange is now a free man. In a controversial and landmark decision, Israel's Supreme Court unanimously ruled the military must begin drafting ultra-Orthodox Jewish men. Ultra-Orthodox men spend much of their early lives entirely devoted to religious study and have been exempt from Israel's mandatory draft since its founding in 1948. The High Court ruled that there is no legal basis for this exemption, a decision that could bolster Israeli forces as the war in Gaza stretches on. Ultra-Orthodox parties hold a lot of political power and are key partners in Netanyahu's fragile governing coalition. Analysts say their opposition to the ruling could ultimately cause Israel's government to collapse. A big step for Ukraine as it began historic membership negotiations this week with the European Union. The move signals confidence in the war-torn nation, which will now attempt complicated judicial, economic, and constitutional reforms required for membership. EU nations enjoy more political stability, trade, and investment than those neighbors not in the group, and the process to join takes years. The EU also began entry talks with Moldova, another former Soviet country, facing pressure from Russia. The face of the U.S. diplomacy is changing at the Vatican. Ambassador Joe Donnelly is entering his final week as the Biden administration's diplomat to the Holy See. A former U.S. senator from Indiana, Donnelly has been the ambassador for 2 years. He sat down with our correspondent Colin Flynn, and while he would not say exactly why he was leaving, he did comment on what an honor it was to serve in Rome.
One thing you learn when you're over here is that everyone else in the world looks to the United States, that they look to us to lead, they look to us to make sensible policy, that so many of the other ambassadors come up to me and said, we're so grateful for your country's help.
There has been speculation Donnelly might soon get involved again in elective politics back home in Indiana. Colum's full interview with the ambassador can be seen on our social media channels. Pope Francis has appointed Archbishop Georg Gainswein, the former private secretary to the late Pope Benedict XVI, to a new diplomatic role. The announcement comes after months of speculation about the Archbishop's future in the church. Gainsvine served as Benedict's personal secretary from 2003 until his death on New Year's Eve 2022. Just a couple of months later, Pope Francis sent Gainsvine home to Germany without any official role. Vatican observers noted that the relationship between Pope Francis and Gainsvine seemed notably strained, with Francis even saying Benedict was being used by the German archbishop. Gainsvine will now serve as apostolic nuncio to Lithuania, Estonia, and Latvia, performing diplomatic duties as a papal ambassador. The Pope's top advisor to combat sexual abuse is urging Vatican offices to stop displaying artwork by disgraced mosaic artist Father Marco Rupnik. In a letter sent this week, Cardinal Sean O'Malley told Vatican offices continued use of Rupnik's work ignores the pain of victims and could imply a defense of the ex-Jesuit priest. This news comes the same day five women who say they were abused by Rupnik sent letters to Catholic bishops around the world asking them to remove his mosaics because their continued display in places of worship was inappropriate and re-traumatizing. This scandal was revived just last week when the head of the Vatican's communications opened the floor to journalist questions and seemed taken aback when the topic of Father Rupnik arose. It once again reignited a global conversation about what the Catholic Church should do with sacred art when the artist faces serious sexual abuse allegations. Paolo Ruffini, the head of the Vatican's communications office, usually speaks to reporters in Rome, but last week addressed questions in Atlanta, Georgia, at the Catholic Media Association's annual conference. What started as a talk on journalism hosted by EWTN took a hard turn when the journalists in the room started asking why the Vatican communications office still features artwork from the disgraced mosaic creator, Father Marco Rupnik.
The walls of the church are our self-portrait. This is the church.
Rupnik, who has been excommunicated once and already dismissed from the Jesuit order, has been accused by about 30 women of serial sexual and psychological abuse in his role as spiritual director for a community of women religious in his native Slovenia. In October, Pope Francis lifted the statute of limitations on Rupnik's case for it to receive a full review. The head of Vatican Communications told reporters last week he disagrees that Rupnik's art should be taken down, saying, quote, "I don't think we have to throw stones thinking that this is the way of healing something. This is not the way to be close to the victims. Do you think that if I pull away a photo of art from my website, our website, I would be more close to victims? Do you think so? Really, do you think so?" Ruffini also said, "We're not talking about abuse of minors." Reaction was immediate from multiple Catholic press outlets. And in an editorial, EWTN's sister publication, the National Catholic Register, called the comments shockingly tone-deaf and indefensible. This comes as Catholics grapple with what to do with Rupnik's art, which decorates more than 200 churches and shrines around the world, including at Lourdes, Fatima, and the Vatican. The Bishop of Lourdes says he is considering removing Rupnik's art from the Marian Shrine. To discuss this ongoing story, we are joined now by Father Thomas Petrie, a moral theologian and president of the Dominican House of Studies in Washington, D.C. Father, thank you for being here for this important conversation. In the latest development, Cardinal Sean O'Malley is asking the Vatican to stop displaying Rupnik's art. I want to acknowledge that you have been outspoken on whether you believe Rupnik's art should be taken down. Can you first lay out your opinion on this matter?
Well, thanks be to God for Cardinal O'Malley, who shows great courage and bravery in standing up for those who are traumatized by sexual abuse. I mean, it's outrageous. Dr. Paolo Ruffini, his comments that we shouldn't judge and that the case is ongoing, not only remarkably tone deaf, but I think really oblivious and insensitive to the real issue at play here, which is that Marco Rupnik created his art in a very scandalous and sacrilegious way. This is not a typical situation of simply a sinner, since we're all sinners. It goes to how the art was even created. I would not even call it sacred art at this point.
Mm. As part of his Q&A with journalists last week, Ruffini, the head of Vatican Communications, also said, quote, "Removing, deleting, destroying art does not ever mean a good choice. This is not a Christian response." Father, you are a moral theologian. Can removing art be a Christian response?
Oh, absolutely. And in this case, I would not even consider this art. You know, I think others have made the comment, and I don't know if Ruffini did or not, but that, you know, Caravaggio was a murderer, and we still have are still displaying his art in churches around Rome and around Europe. It's apples and oranges. The difference here, yes, there are all sorts of sinners who do all sorts of things and can still do all sorts of good things and beautiful things for God. And it is true, and some have drawn the analogy with the sacraments, that sinful priests can still minister grace-filled sacraments. Mm. But in the case of Rupnik's art, what we know and what the accusations are is that he sexually abused consecrated women as the very process of creating the art, which means that it was profaned from the get-go. Mm. And on top of that, not only did he assault these women, it was actually an act of sacrilege. The church defines sacrilege as profaning or being irreverent towards a thing, a place or a person who is consecrated and set apart for God. He engaged in sacrilege and assault in his so-called artistic process. That, in my view, stains the whole thing and is apples and oranges from the mere fact that any artist and every person is a sinner.
I want to flesh that out even just a little bit more because, yes, Ruffini did make that Caravaggio comparison, but Rupnik's, like you said, his alleged victims say his artistic creations are intrinsically linked to his manipulations. And that really makes this uniquely troubling. Right, Father?
Well, the analogy I would use, I mean, we can go back to Caravaggio. If Caravaggio or any artist were to, say, engage in some ritual murder as part of his creating the art, if he were to actually crucify somebody in order to paint the crucifixion of Jesus Christ, or to use the blood, I'm sorry to be graphic on this, to use somebody's blood of a that would be a profanation. It would be sacrilegious. It's not sacred art from the get-go. In this case with Rupnik, I think it's a double sacrilege. Not only what he did to these consecrated women, but in effect attempting to profane, not attempting, he did profane, if these accusations are true, and it seems that they are. He was excommunicated for this, or for certainly forgiving someone for committing the sin against the sixth commandment, which he was excommunicated for. It's profaning the very art that he's attempting to make, and therefore, I don't think it comes to the definition of sacred.
Let alone art, to your point earlier.
Yeah.
Rupnik's mosaics are displayed at some of the most iconic Catholic pilgrimage sites, Lourdes, Fatima, the Vatican. Father, can you speak to that? And can the faithful still have profound spiritual experiences there in spite of that?
I think that's the right word. And right now, in spite of that and not because of that, this is going to be a profound and difficult and complicated process. You're right. I mean, Rupnik's mosaics are everywhere, and usually they're broad and massive, usually encompassing whole walls or sometimes the entire interior of a church space. I don't expect that we'll see a lot of movement on removing those mosaics until the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith completes its investigation, its canonical investigation, which they are currently doing. Mm-hmm. I suspect once that's done and it is determined that, in fact, he is guilty of these crimes, and I suspect it will be determined. I have no reason not to believe these women. It's going to be more incumbent on those. It's going to be a tremendous expense, a tremendous problem. I think there are creative ways to do it, but I'll leave that sort of to the artist and the architects and to those in charge of this.
Well, and we'll leave the conversation right there. Father Thomas Petrie, thank you for being here for this important topic.
Thank you so much, Catherine. Always good to be with you.
Thank you, Father. The future of the first publicly funded Catholic charter school is in limbo after the Oklahoma Supreme Court ruled it unconstitutional. St. Isidore of Seville Catholic Virtual School, a project of the Oklahoma Diocese's, hoped to provide a Catholic education at no cost to students across the state, but it faced legal challenges from the Oklahoma Attorney General shortly after being approved as a charter school last year. The state's high court sided with the Attorney General on Tuesday, ruling that the curriculum constituted as government funding of religion. University of Notre Dame law professor Rick Garnett maintains the school did not violate the state constitution.
This is not a form of discrimination that's required by the separation of church and state. The our Constitution and Oklahoma's Constitution, correctly understood, permit these kind of cooperative arrangements. St. Isidore wouldn't involve the establishment of a state religion. It would just mean giving parents and kids more options, and it's their choice whether they choose to attend this school or not.
In response to the ruling, Archbishop Paul Coakley of Oklahoma City said, "We will consider all legal options and remain steadfast in our belief that St. Isidore would have and could still be a valuable asset to students, regardless of socioeconomic, race, or faith backgrounds." In response to that ruling, Oklahoma's top education official directed every classroom in the state to teach the Bible. State Superintendent Ryan Walters says adherence to the mandate is compulsory, though it is not clear if he has authority to enforce it. This directive comes just a week after Louisiana's governor signed a bill requiring all public classrooms to display the Ten Commandments. These mandates have received backlash from non-Christian communities in Oklahoma, and critics are saying they violate the separation of church and state. And this update now to an important story from earlier this year. Nearly 3 months after crashing into a Baltimore bridge, the cargo ship Dolly successfully made it to Virginia. The vessel was on its way out of the Baltimore harbor when it collided with a support on the Francis Scott Key Bridge, causing the structure to collapse and to kill 6 workers. The Dolly reached Norfolk on Tuesday under its own power with the guidance of 4 tugboats. The accident disrupted operations at the Port of Baltimore, the 9th busiest port in the U.S. for international cargo. It fully reopened to maritime traffic earlier this June. Officials say the replacement bridge, a key commuter route, will not be finished until 2028. When we return back to the shrine Mother Angelica built in Hansville, as we join the pilgrims on procession. As we close tonight, we take you back to the shrine of the Most Blessed Sacrament in Hansville, Alabama, the final home and resting place of Mother Angelica. No doubt the foundress of EWTN would have been pleased to see that so many pilgrims came to worship, pray, and process along the St. Juan Diego route of the National Eucharistic Pilgrimage. Stunning. Mother Angelica's Shrine of the Most Blessed Sacrament, a beautiful and sacred place. And that does it for this edition of EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. Please join us again same time next week when we bring you more news from a Catholic perspective. Until then, have a blessed week.